We're beginning 1 Peter 5, the last chapter in this amazing epistle. So I'm going to read from verse 1. To the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder and witness of Christ's sufferings and one who will also share the glory to be revealed. And this verse is another example of sufferings and glory being placed side by side in Peter's epistle. And so a witness of Christ's sufferings and one who will share in the glory to be revealed. You remember, sufferings is used 16 times and glory is used 16 times in 1 Peter. Now, as far as this statement, I appeal to you as a fellow elder, in Israel, older men who were wise and had a good reputation had an unofficial role as informal local rulers in the Old Testament. You remember, often there's that phrase about the elders sitting in the gates as they would pass judgments. Then in the 1st century AD, we find them having a role of leadership in the synagogues. It wasn't normally the religious officials that we read of in the New Testament, the scribes, the Sadducees, etc. But more in the local synagogue, it was the elders who had a role of leadership. Doesn't mean to say that the other more technical scholars couldn't speak on the Sabbath, but the general oversight was in the hand of people that they called elders, stemming from that tradition. And it seems that the church took over this tradition and adopted elders as a term of those who would oversight local congregations. And Peter, although he is an apostle, calls himself a fellow elder here in verse 1. And also in verse 2, he'll call himself a shepherd or a pastor. So it would seem that being an apostle and having a translocal itinerant ministry does not mean abdicating the responsibility of serving in a local congregation. And we find the same with Paul's relationship with the church in Antioch. You remember, after each missionary journey, he would return to what in effect was his home church or his home base and give a report. There were no loose cannons in the early church, and there should be none in the church today. All of us need to be accountable and embedded in a local congregation, even if we have national or even international ministries. So verse 2, which I alluded to, Peter says, be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, serving as overseers. The word is episkopoi, to oversee, which actually I mentioned in the previous chapter, I think. And we get the word bishop, although that's kind of freighted with meaning today. It was really just an alternative to elder. Elder being speaking of somebody older and wiser, and episkopoi simply meaning the person who would oversee the sheep. And so an elder perhaps was a title, but then overseeing was one of his functions. So be shepherds of God's flock that's under your care, not because you must, but because you're willing, as God wants you to be. Not greedy for money, but eager to serve. And the image of a shepherd, of course, was a description of God in the Old Testament, and one which was, of course, used by Jesus as a description of himself. I am the good shepherd. That reference in John 10 is not simply kind of a pastoral, cozy term, but it's a divine title. Yahweh was the shepherd of Israel. And this description of a shepherd as a leader, and we should remember that kings in the Old Testament were also called shepherds. They were under shepherds, under the Lord God, who was the shepherd. And so the description of a shepherd as a leader depicts one who's very different from the hierarchies of authority that we've come to expect from those in high office today, and indeed those in high office in the Roman Empire. According to Jesus, a shepherd is not only prepared to care for the flock, but even to lay down his life for them if necessary. And this is the charge that Peter is given by Jesus. You remember, Peter betrayed the Lord three times, and then after the resurrection, three times in John 21, Jesus tells Peter to feed his flock, to shepherd his flock. And this verse goes on to say that elders must not be those greedy for money, but those eager to serve. And accusations of being in it for what they could get out of it were often made against philosophers, astrologers, and magicians in the ancient world, who raked in a lot of money for their services. And it was therefore crucial that Christian leaders avoided the appearance of being in ministry to gain money, and even more so, as it was the church leaders who were in charge of the funds that were collected each week and distributed to the poor. And as an aside, money, as in the phrase "not greedy for money," was translated "filthy lucre." Money was "filthy lucre" in the older versions. And Francis of Assisi, you probably know, would never ever accept money. If somebody actually pressed some money in his hand, he would throw it away, because he just wanted to depend upon the gifts of God's children as he traveled around preaching the good news and praying for the needy. He'd not only throw away money if he met a beggar who had very little clothing. Francis would strip off his own clothing and give it to the beggar. His brothers were embarrassed, as Francis would often be walking naked for a while until they could somehow scrounge up some more clothes for him. This phrase, "filthy lucre," was one certainly that St. Francis would embrace. And in fact, again, just as an aside, I remember after the movement had got going, and of course it spread throughout Europe, largely among young people, and Francis decided that they would have a convocation. They would just gather all the young people who were joining the Franciscan movement. So they just gave a time, a date, and mentioned a town and said it would be in a big field outside the town. And they made no provision for food, for shelter, for toilets, for anything. And 30,000 young people turned up. And it was called the Convocation of the Straw Hats, because it was so hot that they picked straw and wove it into hats to give them a little bit of shade. But fortunately, they didn't die of hunger and thirst, as the local people realized that this was a move of God and came out with food and water for them. But that was filthy lucre. Then verse 3. Not lording it over those allotted to your care, but being examples to the flock. As, of course, Jesus, the great shepherd, was the perfect example and is the perfect example to all who are shepherds in the church today. So, not lording it over those allotted to your care. This could be translated, not being petty tyrants over those allotted to your care. As I've said, leadership in the church is not dominance, but servanthood, and we must never forget it. And the phrase "allotted to your care," excuse me, the phrase "allotted to your care" is ton kleron in the Greek. And again, Barclay notes that in Deuteronomy 9:29, we read that Israel is the heritage, literally in the Septuagint, the kleros of God. And so allotted is ton kleron, and then Israel is the allotment, if you like, the kleros of God. That's to say, Israel were the people who God regarded in a special way as entrusted or allotted to his care. So under the Old Covenant, Israel was the kleros of God, and in a similar way, under the New Covenant, the church is the kleros of God. However, its care is now committed to the oversight of elders and pastors who are now God's under-shepherds over the flock. And this means that the whole attitude and commitment of elders to the people under their charge must be the same as the attitude and commitment of that which God has himself for his people. And this makes the task of being an elder something that someone should not take lightly. So on to verse 4. And when the chief shepherd appears, Jesus, as I said, is still a shepherd and will continue to be one even at his second coming. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory. And this was a garland that was given to athletes in the games. You'll receive a crown of glory that will never fade away. Elders will receive a crown of glory, because being an elder now is often a crown of thorns, is often a thankless task, as Peter himself well knew. But he says that they will receive a crown of glory to replace the crown of thorns, and it's a crown that will never fade away. Unlike the garlands that were given in the ancient Olympics, they faded away fast, but this is one that will not fade. And verse 5, young men, in the same way, be submissive. And of course, the temptation of those who are young and strong is to be assertive rather than submissive. Young men, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older, or it could be translated to the elders. We're unsure here whether it's just an admonition for the young to be in submission to the old, because elder is the word older, so it could go both ways. And then continuing verse 5, all of us, notice it's all of us, Peter is including himself and the congregation, are to clothe ourselves with humility towards one another. Now, humility was despised as weakness by the Greeks, but as we know from Moses, who was called in Numbers the meekest man on the face of the earth, and from Jesus, who called himself meek and lowly of heart, we know that meekness is not weakness. And in this, the Greeks had it all wrong, when they despised humility as weakness. And it's something that Peter, the elders, and the congregation, and ourselves, this is to be our clothing. So clothe yourselves with humility to one another, because, and here he quotes Proverbs 3, God opposes the proud. And that's a very strong word. God opposes the proud, even if they're his people. Even if they're a believer, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. It's a sobering verse. And the word to clothe here was used of a slave putting on an apron, and is the same word that's used when Jesus, you remember, in John 13, put on an apron and washed his disciples' feet at the Last Supper. And it's also worth noting, as I said, that if we're proud, God himself will oppose. The other translation is God himself will resist us. And as I say, it's a sobering thing to think that God could be resisting us. But pride, will both hinder our prayers and impede the flow of grace into our lives. God will resist it. God will turn off the tap of grace, as it were. And by way of contrast, if we're humble, if we share the meekness and humility of Jesus, we'll then find the grace and favor resting powerfully, powerfully upon us. And perhaps I should add that you can't make yourself humble. You can't make yourself humble. Once you think you have it, you can be sure you've lost it. Okay, the person who says they're finally humble probably now has a problem with deception. So we can't make ourselves humble, but we can humble ourselves. We can choose to be servants. We can refuse the desire for status and position and all such choices, and make choices of humbling ourselves, of taking the low place. And this will put us in a position where it's like living under a waterfall of God's grace. That tremendous thing when God doesn't need to resist us, rather he just plunges us under a waterfall of grace, and that's where we live. And I remember, this was some time ago, a leader from the West exploring some of the church planting movements in China, and he was way out in the interior, and he came to the outskirts of a town, and there was a man there working on a manure pile, and he got talking to him, and he realized he was a believer, and he said he'd like to meet the leader of the house church movement in the town. And the man working on the manure pile, he smiled and he said, "I lead the house church movement in that town." And they felt that leadership had to take a humble position. He didn't need to do that. It wasn't his job, but he wanted to demonstrate that even leaders need to humble themselves under the mighty hand of God. And that brings up the phrase in verse 6, "Humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he might lift you up in due time." And the phrase, "the mighty hand of God," is common in the Old Testament and is often used in connection with the Exodus. For instance, in Exodus 13:9, we read, "With a strong hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt," or in Deuteronomy 3:24, "You have only begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand." So Peter is hinting that if God could deliver his people from the might of the empire of Egypt, he can also deliver his people from the might of the Roman Empire and from all who persecute them. Once we deal with pride, once we deal with pride, there's no limit to how God can and will lift us up in Peter's words, and reveal his mighty hand in our midst. And then finally, a verse which everyone knows by heart, verse 7, "Cast all your anxiety or all your care on him, because he cares for you." And notice we're not told to cast off our anxieties. This is impossible and becomes a futile exercise in positive thinking. But while we can't cast them off by simply deciding to, we can, as it were, cast them on. Peter says that there is a place where we can lay them down, cast them on, and be truly free. And so Peter's words is not to cast them off, but to cast them on Jesus. And we can do this with confidence and peace, as we know that he truly cares for us. And once they're laid on him, we also discover that what we are called to bear is not crushing anxiety, but a yoke that's easy and a burden that's light. Somebody says that because God cares for us, life is now out to make us and not to break us. I like that. Life is now out to make us and not to break us. And even our sufferings and our trials can now become redemptive and used to advance the work of the kingdom through our lives.